We'll be back after the news. Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. We're speaking to you today in the middle of Sunshine Week. And no, that is not a reference to the weather outside, which is delightful and sunny. It actually refers to a quote by former Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, who said, "Publicity is justly commended as a remedy for social and industrial diseases. Sunlight is said to be the best of disinfectant. Electric light, the most efficient policeman." What Brandeis is referring to is transparency, as it's come to be known today. Within the last couple weeks, the First Amendment, the New England Center for... It's the New England First Amendment Coalition gave an award to several people. One was Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy for his lifetime of work defending and upholding transparency. But the other was to a reporter, Jennifer Kim, who is a former reporter for the Boston Globe and is now with the New England Center for Investigative Reporting. Since starting in the fall of 2013, her stories on child welfare and homeowner debt have been the recipient of national awards and regional awards from the New England Newspaper and Press Association. Before joining the New England Center for Investigative Reporting, she worked as a social issues and business reporter at the Boston Globe and covered a number of social justice issues, including domestic sex trafficking of minors and also an in-depth look at child pornography. Her award-winning series that she won this award for this past few weeks is about child abuse in Massachusetts and the failings of the Massachusetts Department of Children and Families, or DCF, just as it's known here in Vermont, where she found that children were dying because of a lack of oversight by this government agency. Jennifer McKim, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So talk a little bit about this series that you wrote about the Massachusetts DCF. What did you find?
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much for asking. This was really sort of a labor of love. It took a lot of time, and it wouldn't have happened without public records laws that gave us the teeth to be able to ask for these questions, because so much of what happens with children who die of abuse and neglect is hidden behind these laws of confidentiality and silence. So basically what we did was we threw public records requests that took us a lot of time and a lot of money. We were able to learn about the deaths of 110 children who died between 2009 and 2013, who the state determined had died of abuse and neglect, and be able to sort of look at them systemically and say, what happened with these kids? How did they die? How were they failed? About a third of them had been under the watch of the Department of Children and Families, so there were many warning signs and missed opportunities to save children that really didn't happen. And basically, we sort of went through this list and were able to learn that, you know, mistakes that were happening within the state that were failing to catch the risks that these children were in.
What were some of the mistakes being made by the Massachusetts DCF that was resulting in these kids dying?
So, across the country, children die of abuse and neglect every year. Something like 1,600 of them, I think, annually is sort of the undercount. And so many of these children die who we really never know what happens with. But when we looked at these deaths and looked at these stories and tried to unravel them, I mean, you find a lot of sort of just missed opportunities, like how could they have missed this? How did they not see that this child was in danger, the mother was on drugs, or, you know, there's these different things that happened. But basically, we kind of went beyond that and really tried to look. And what we found some particular things that were able to basically that have been changed since we found them out. So that in that way, it was encouraging. One of the things we found was a child who died, who was an infant, who had been shaken to death by his father, who had PTSD. And had been in a bunch of had a whole series of court cases for domestic abuse and animal cruelty and other troubles. It was clearly he was unraveling from his time at war. And one of the things we found was that when somebody calls into the state and says, I'm worried about a kid, the state was not required to even do a criminal history check on this person. Whereas, I don't know if you know, but if you're a parent and you want to volunteer in school, read a book, do anything, you have to have a criminal history check. But they weren't doing that when they were calling in for allegations of abuse and neglect in kids. So we and if they had, they would have seen that this guy was definitely problematic. He was having troubles. And so the governor, within a week of our story running, said that he's going to basically, they did it often, but it wasn't required, and that he was going to require that in all cases when there was troubles, that they would, when there was a call into the state of suspicious abuse or neglect, that they would do a criminal history check. So that was one thing that we found. We also found that, and this is an issue, and actually I can't tell you if this is something that's done in Vermont, but that there was a two-track system in Massachusetts in something like two-thirds of the states in the union, where they would put kids on a lower-risk track or a higher-risk track. And the problem was that kids on the lower-risk track were also dying. That child who I just told you about, who they had decided that he was at lower risk because they only thought that the family needed help. If they had looked harder, they might have thought he was at higher risk, but he ended up dying. And so since then, in Massachusetts, they've decided to eliminate that two-track system altogether. And I know other states in the union are also looking at that.
So, first of all, it's a staggering number. You're talking about 110 child fatalities in, a 3 or 4 year period. And that alone is eye-popping.
5 year period, 2009 to 2013, but yes.
Okay. So, you know, one of the things, and this, I think, is this issue is ubiquitous. It does not matter what state you're in. We also are hearing stories of this, and we hear from, I think just last week, I was listening to testimonials from Vermont DCF workers who talk about, you know, people are quick to say, why didn't we remove that kid? But this is a very severe sanction to remove a child from a home. It is done, you know, there's a lot of legal steps that have to be taken. And, of course, these agencies are typically severely understaffed. How do you respond to that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, when I did this project, which took me about a year and a half altogether from the beginning of that first public records request to the time that our stories ran, we spent a lot of time talking to the social workers and the social workers union in Massachusetts. And clearly, one of the biggest problems is that they, are overworked and understaffed. The budget had dropped incredibly from 2008. So as the fatalities went up, the budget was going down. So there seemed to be a correlation in that. And so, yes, there are social workers struggle with so many different things, trying to decide every, you know, these life or death decisions. But also, they need a system in place that helps them. And the social workers union, in our case, was very concerned from the beginning that they had implemented this two-tier track in 2008 or 2009, that they were concerned that that would make it more difficult for them to save children, because then it was hard for them to decide which child should be on which track. And if they're on the lower risk track, maybe they wouldn't look at them as much because they're more heightened and concerned about the higher risk. So they had issues themselves with those things.
What's the solution? What, from your, you know, you've obviously spent long hours looking at the shortfalls at a DCF system in Massachusetts. Do you see a way forward that, could fix these problems in Massachusetts and elsewhere?
Well, thank you for asking me that, and of course, this sort of fits directly into the discussion that we're having this week, which is about Sunshine. And I'm not a PhD in child welfare, but I can tell you that if you don't open up the books and look under the rocks and learn about these deaths, you're never going to know anything and you're never going to find improvements. And what we found was because we looked and we examined and we fought for records that we had to fight for over a long period of time. There's a whole program of what they called child fatality review, and basically the idea is when a child dies that you examine it to learn from it and prevent the next deaths. And basically the child fatality review system is is really troubled, and a lot of these cases are not examined. The states are very restrained in trying to give information to the public, and without giving that information, really, it's really hard to figure out what went on, what went wrong.
We're talking with Jennifer McKim. She is a reporter for the New England Center for Investigative Reporting, and she has just won the 2016 Freedom of Information Award from the New England First Amendment Coalition for her series of articles called Out of the Shadows, Shining Light on State Failure to Learn from Rising Child Abuse and Neglect Deaths about the Massachusetts DCF system. So, Jennifer, and thank you for steering it back to Sunshine, which it is, again, Sunshine Week, celebrating transparency and open records throughout the country. You face some incredible obstacles in just obtaining this information. Tell us a little bit about those and what you had to do to get this information about the children.
I'm happy to do that. And I just sort of start from the beginning that the whole reason, back to the idea of child fatality review, is to not really as much to place blame, but to prevent the next deaths, and that any child abuse neglect death by its very nature is preventable. It's something that didn't have to happen. And so that looking at these things is the only way to find them out. And basically, when you have children in the government system that are under the government's watch, it is all of our duties to make sure that when a child dies, we learn from it to prevent the next one from happening. So sort of starting from that, that is why there's this federal law called the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act that was passed, I think, first in 1974 and in 2010 was amended, with basically public disclosure law requiring states to provide certain information to the public when asked. So basically it said if a child dies, the state has to answer these five questions, you know, when a child died, where, if they had some history with the state, and if they received any services, what kind, and basically, again, to learn from this mistake. And so basically I filed under this CAPTA law, which anyone in any state, reporters in Vermont can do and anywhere else, basically ask for this information under CAPTA is the way it's the acronym for it. And so I filed that first request in December of 2013, and it started this long process. And the state agreed that this was information that they did have to provide. No one had really used these legal terms before to get the information, but they said, you know, this is going to be very expensive. And so we spent a long time negotiating. We appealed to the Secretary of State, which is the process in Massachusetts to fight what we considered was a denial, because at first we considered it was too much money for a nonprofit like the New England Center for Investigative Reporting to pay, and also
how much money
as,
were they?
How much was it going to cost the public?
How much was it going to cost?
Well, so it ended up we got denied, and so I think we first asked for a year, and it was a couple thousand, and then we got denied, and then we decided if we're going to pay, we're going to have to. We want more than 1 year, so we ended up paying $4,500 for 5 years of data. And the Boston Globe partnered with us on getting this information and paying for it. So,
what is the justification for asking for that kind of money for public records?
Right, which is basically this information that it's supposed to be public and as important as it is, and to sort of prevent, make it that hard to get is I find really astounding. And the argument was that it would take a long time for the government workers to get the information. Part of the law is also that if the government is supposed to have some sort of process to provide it to the public, and yet basically what they had to do was go through every file and talk to social workers to answer these questions about each of these children. So basically they're so disorganized and the information is so sort of kept in so many different places that they have to require this type of money to get it. And then they said it would take a couple months, and it took more like 8 months to get the, and something like that. We finally gave them money in August of 2014. We got our first data started in January, and then through the spring, they gave us phases over several years at a time because it was taking them so long. And not only did it take them forever and I had to pressure and question and call, the data was also very messy. There was a lot of misspelled names and dates of deaths wrong and children who at first they said were open cases and then they were closed cases. And so there's a lot of information about, again, children who died under state watch that is just poorly kept.
Your stories were first published by the New England New England Center for Investigative Reporting, but also in the Boston Sunday Globe, and then cited in more than 20 other local and national news organizations, including the New Yorker, Huffington Post, Politico, and others. And it resulted in changes in state policy. Tell us about that.
Right. So I think I said that a little bit at the beginning. I think the two biggest steps, I mean, it was part of a whole, I would say, there's been a lot of work in Massachusetts over the last couple of years on child fatalities, starting with this death of a little boy in 2013. His name was Jeremiah Oliver, a five-year-old from Fitchburg, about 45 minutes out of Boston, who disappeared and then was found on the side of the road, and he had been under state watch, and so there was a large focus from lots of journalists in this area on what happened to Jeremiah, and then the string of other horrible deaths. So it wasn't just my reporting. It's been sort of a body of work that's been happening in the state. And then after that, there was another little girl first called Baby Doe, who was found. I mean, it's such sad stuff. I'm sorry, but it is important to talk about. But another little baby who was found, I think, in a trash bag in Boston Harbor, and they didn't even know her name. And it took a while until they found out that she was also a child who had been under state watch before she had been killed. So allegedly killed. I think the court case is still underway. But basically, so my story was one of them. But basically what we were able to do was to look at it systemically, look at these 110 kids rather than every year there's another high-profile case in every state in the union. But we were able to look at it sort of say, I mean, and our story came out right when Baby Doe, they discovered what her name was and who she was. And so not only was it this one other tragic case, but all these other children whose stories often are never told. And again, the things that I think it contributed to the complete overhaul of the system in Massachusetts in terms of looking at how to assess risk with kids, but sort of specifically some of the things that I talked to you about earlier. Now they're always doing these criminal history checks. They've eliminated this two-tier system altogether so that they're focusing on trying to assess risks and also better supervise the workers. So there's been a lot that's being done right now here in the state.
Well, let's turn to another case, and we're talking again with Jennifer McKen. She is a senior reporter at the New England Center for Investigative Reporting. Another case you've been working on is that of Daryl Jones, who was convicted of murder. Tell us about Daryl Jones. Who is he, and what did he do, and how did you get involved in his case?
So Daryl Jones is a 48-year-old African-American man from Boston who 30 years ago was convicted of a murder in Brockton, which is outside of Boston, for murder that he says he never, that he's innocent of, that he did not commit. And he is claiming that he was one of this growing masses of wrongfully convicted people in America, and he is fighting his case. He just filed a motion to reopen his case in October. I was approached by his wife, who he had married, who he had met and married while in prison, who is a youth activist, and she told me about his case, and I went in to meet him, and we decided to examine his innocence plea and see, you know, what validity there was and learn about the justice system as part of the process. And it was been a really amazing ride for us, basically following down the paths of witnesses and other folks who were involved in his case 30 years ago. But basically, Daryl Jones was convicted of a murder, although there was no physical evidence to prove that he was the one who killed this man named Guillermo Rodriguez. There was eyewitness testimony, but no eyewitnesses said in court that they believed that he was the shooter, and there was no motive. So it's a perplexing case, and when we looked at it, we did find a lot of questions about whether he was rightfully convicted of this crime.
And you then took his case to an investigative journalism class that you teach for Emerson College and students at BU. And what happened then?
I've been a journalist for over 25 years, and I've written stories that have engaged people, but few, if any, have sort of garnered the type of passion in other people as this one has. And so, yes, the New England Center for Investigative Reporting teaches a class at Boston University, combination Boston-Emerson class, and we decided to focus the semester on Darrell Jones' innocence claims. And so basically, as students, they got into teams. One looked at the attorney who defended him, who ended up being suspended months after Darrell Jones' conviction for embezzlement, and only later admitted that he was completely distracted at the time that that case happened. We had another group looking at the police department, which was under its own spotlight for missing cocaine, and the police chief later, 5 years later, admitted to stealing cocaine and being an addict at the time. There was a lot of interesting stuff in this case. And then also talking to Darrell Jones and going out to meet him in prison. And he was, he very much speaks his case. And he had amassed an incredible amount of documentation, which is sort of gets us back to the Sunshine Week, that he provided us incredible amounts of documentation to better tell his story and look at his, you know, claims of innocence.
I'm struck by, you wrote about the odyssey and challenges of covering this story. When you went to visit Darrell Jones, you were stopped in several times because the prison didn't like what you were wearing.
It was pretty startling for me. I haven't visited I have been to prison before, but not for a long time. And it struck me what families who are visiting people have to face every day to go in and visit someone in prison, because basically, you know, you're given a certain amount of time, and then you show up, and then you wait a long time, and then they have certain rules about what you can wear that are pretty hard to understand. I mean, basically my shirt was too low cut, which was just startling to me. I mean, honestly, if you looked at it, it was nothing revealing. And so then I had to go running out of the prison because I only had a few more minutes before visiting hour would be over, even though I showed up an hour early, and had to go buy a T-shirt at a local shop that, you know, that more fit the tastes of the people in the system. Another time I showed up, and I knew enough to bring a bag of clothing because I wasn't sure which would get by, and I found troubles again because my sweater had a hood, and you're not allowed to wear hoods, and then the shirt was the sleeves were too short, and then the back was too low cut, and it was a little bizarre.
Wow.
But yeah, it's definitely, and again, when I've talked to people in the system, they just say, yeah, that's one of the things. They know people who've come from out of state to visit a grandson, or, you know, grandmother who comes from somewhere else to visit someone and then is not let in because something in their wardrobe doesn't fit.
Now, we just have a minute left, but just to fast forward, so just yesterday you wrote that Darrell Jones has been granted a hearing to overturn his murder conviction.
Right. So he has, over the last 30 years, he's filed several different legal efforts to get his case reopened, and his latest one was filed in October. He was granted a status hearing next month, which is not, you know, but it's a baby step. And he was actually asked, he's been directed by the court to attend the hearing, which is the first time, he says, in 30 years that he is actually able to stand in a courtroom again and start the process of fighting his case.
Wow. Well, you have really a remarkable record of making a difference for the people and topics that you write about. Jennifer McKim, I want to thank you for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you very much for having me. My father lives in Dummerston, so I have a great affection for Vermont.
Okay, great. Jennifer McKim is a senior reporter for the New England Center for Investigative Reporting and the winner of the 2016 Freedom of Information Award from the New England First Amendment Coalition. That'll do it for this week's Vermont Conversation. You can hear this and all shows at VermontConversation.com. I'm David Goodman, and I'll be back next Wednesday at 1 with another Vermont Conversation.
The previous hour has been presented by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, featuring interviews with leading changemakers from around Vermont and around the world. It's underwritten by The Alchemist, serving the greater Waterbury community and Vermont since 2003. By UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. By Vermont National Life Group, which lives its values every day. Do good, be good, make good. By Coffee World, your local digital print shop, offering quick design and printing services for projects of all sizes. By Green Mountain Power, partnering with customers on energy innovations while delivering clean, reliable, and cost-effective power, as well as over 750 VBSR businesses.
And you're listening to locally owned and operated 96.1 WDEV FM in Warren, FM 96.5 Barrie, and AM 550 WDEV Waterbury, Montpelier. We're serving the kingdom at FM 101.9 from Island Pond.
AP Radio News.